Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the economy, not a trader was stirring for fear of another Ponzi. Stock prices went up the chimney to our despair, while profits and nest eggs vanished into thin air. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat, now available at splendidtable.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday. It is the 24th of December. The investing career of this season's most notorious Grinch, alleged Ponzi schemer Bernard Madoff, may be over, but his career as a court defendant is just beginning. And Madoff will have some company in the courtroom. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has more on the legal unraveling that is yet to come.
Bernie Madoff's victims aren't going to get much money out of him. He'll be broke before the first few investors are repaid. But funds that invested their clients' cash with Madoff may be held responsible.
We're investigating whether the funds actually performed adequate due diligence before they invested the fund's fund into Madoff's hands.
That's attorney Theodore Eppenstein, who's representing people who didn't even know they were invested with Madoff. And then there are the people who were invested and took out money at some point. That's where more lawsuits spring up, says Adam Levitin, who teaches bankruptcy law at Georgetown.
This could get very messy, no question.
Levitin says any gains collected in the last 6 years or even withdrawals of the principal investment could be recovered to pay other Madoff victims. Attorney Carol Neville represents clients in a similar case involving a hedge fund, the Bayou Group. She says there is a defense for people who can prove they withdrew cash in good faith, not because they knew something funny was going on.
Good faith, having a good faith reason, shelters a clawback of your principal. It does not shelter a clawback of fake profits.
But Neville says the whole process can get awfully complicated and expensive.
What happened in Bayou is that they've collected $33 million so far and they've spent $20 million on legal fees.
And given the scope of the Madoff swindle, I don't even want to know what the legal bill will be. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Ebenezer Scrooge isn't the only one who might see the wisdom of pinching pennies this Christmas. Plunging mortgage rates mean homeowners have a chance to lower their monthly payments, and there is a growing rush to refinance. In just the past week, the Mortgage Bankers Association saw a 48% jump in home loan applications across the country. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has that story.
Mortgage applications don't necessarily translate into actual home sales. Just ask Emily Kinzig of Nashville, Tennessee. She and her husband, Brett, have been trying to buy a home since Thanksgiving, but the banks keep finding reasons not to lend. It's beginning to make her worry about what the loan process itself is doing to their credit.
Every time they make another credit inquiry, from what we can tell, it's affecting our credit score a little bit. And we both have excellent credit scores, so to see it go down a few points every time a new inquiry is made is a little disheartening.
It's a cautionary tale of why home sales are still down even amid a surge in mortgage applications. Home purchases accounted for just 11% of last week's application rush. Overwhelmingly, homeowners are refinancing. Spencer Raskoff tracks mortgage rates on the website Zillow.com. And with borrowing costs now the lowest in 5 years, he knows what he wants for Christmas, a lower house payment.
My message to any homeowner out there is refi now. These are very low rates. They may get a little bit lower, but you know, trying to time that market bottom is almost impossible. I personally am going through a refi right now, if that's any indication. This is a big Christmas present to homeowners.
It turns out it's primarily those who haven't gotten themselves in over their heads who are now seeing the benefits of moves to bring down interest rates. But Raskoff points out this could head off even more foreclosures and ultimately help everyone.
The typical homeowner who refinances now and takes advantage of these low rates will face lower monthly payments and potentially avoid a costly reset of their adjustable rate mortgage, which might have increased their payments in the future. And that will, of course, leave them with more disposable income, better able to pay off their credit card debts, and better able to hopefully consume and hopefully get the economy going again.
In the end, Raskoff says that's the best way to rebuild the housing market. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Well, at least someone is building stuff in this economy, even if it's plastic houses and helicopters. The clickety-clack of Legos appears to be giving Guitar Hero a little old-fashioned competition. Okay, maybe that's overstating things a bit, but the Denmark-based company does expect sales growth of more than 12% in the U.S. compared to last year. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to put the pieces together.
It turns out this year a whole bunch of construction toys are flying off the shelves. Tom's Toys is in Montrose, California. Manager Ted Espinosa says German-made Playmobil is selling well and don't even think of finding Lego.
Normally we have a big selection of Legos, but at this moment we are totally out.
Retail analyst Patricia Edwards says we're seeing a tectonic shift in American consumer culture.
It's not all about the newest, best, whiz-bang stuff at any cost. There is some sense of frugality. There's some sense of wanting things that are going to last longer.
Edwards says the play also lasts longer with Lego than, say, a computer game.
These kids can make things that you would never imagine. I am constantly amazed at what comes out of my kids' bedrooms, and they will drive things out. They will fly things out. You never know what's going to be coming out next.
Edwards thinks it's that kind of creative problem-solving we're all craving right now. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On this shortened day of trading on Wall Street, a Christmas Eve reprieve. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Today, the insurance giant AIG announced it's spending $16 billion worth of its taxpayer-funded loan to buy up some of the assets the company insures. If you're thinking it sounds a little odd for an insurance company to purchase the insured property instead of honoring the terms of the policy, it is. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale tells us there is a chance the strategy might work.
AIG insured securities backed by mortgages and other assets through transactions called credit default swaps. Now that those securities have lost value, AIG is on the hook for hundreds of billions of dollars in payouts. Unable to cover its liabilities, AIG is using the money it borrowed from the government to buy the credit default swaps outright to get the policies off its books. Brian Bethune, chief economist at IHS Global Insight, says it's like a home insurer deciding it's cheaper to buy the house rather than pay the insurance policy.
If, for instance, you wrote an insurance contract on the house for $300,000, and if you can buy it for $250,000, then it may be better actually to buy it at the reduced price and then write off the $300,000 insurance contract.
The problem is, why would the homeowner opt for selling cheap instead of cashing in on the full insurance policy? Bethune says many credit default swap owners are willing to take that loss.
Maybe realistically, some of these asset holders are saying, I'm not going to realize the full value of this insurance anyway, so I may as well take what I can get now rather than deal with the uncertainty of not knowing what I'm going to get in the future.
And for this scheme to work from a taxpayer perspective, the securities AIG is buying will have to eventually appreciate in value to give the company enough money to pay back its government loans. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The auto industry just got the last few billion left of the first half of the bailout money. It'll be up to the Obama administration to ask Congress for the second $350 billion. But that's not the half of it, literally. While the country has been focused on that highly publicized $700 billion rescue package, the Federal Reserve has quietly spent more than $1 trillion behind the scenes to rescue a long list of industries. This shadow bailout has gotten little attention and even less scrutiny. But piece by piece, the Fed has taken over huge chunks of America's financial system. And as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports, it's also taken on enormous and unprecedented risks.
It all began more than a year ago when the Fed started auctioning emergency loans to the world's biggest banks after the credit markets froze. Here's Marketplace's Jill Barshay reporting that day.
Any financial institution can go to it. You can pledge any kind of collateral, even like subprime mortgage bonds, to get your Fed money. And it's a big party.
When the party started, the program was limited to $40 billion. Today, it's lent out close to half a trillion, and it's just one of a dozen new lending programs the Fed's launched. Along with doling out all this money, the Fed's also relaxed its standards for the kinds of collateral it accepts. It's bought up toxic assets from Bear Stearns and now holds billions in exotic debt most private banks wouldn't touch. Catherine Mann's an economist at Brandeis.
Now the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve has mostly bad assets on it.
That's a first for the Fed, according to Alan Blinder, the former vice chairman there.
The Fed is buying all sorts of things that no one ever imagined the Fed would buy. And it is doing this in magnitudes that only 6 months ago we would have thought completely unimaginable.
So why is the Fed taking these risks? Because, according to Blinder, Congress's $700 billion bailout didn't work.
The Fed, unlike any other institution in government, can serve as a lender of last resort in unlimited amounts by creating money.
During the Great Depression, the Fed sat on its hands. Alan Meltzer, an economist and Fed historian, says that transformed a financial crisis into deflation and created the worst economic downturn in modern history.
In 95 years of their history, they have never come up with a meaningful, clear program of what they're going to do in a crisis to help the financial markets.
This time, Meltzer says the Fed has used its powers with abandon, but its approach has been all over the map. So how much have they spent? Let's add it up. A half trillion on those emergency loans to big banks. $200 billion in temporary swaps, treasury bills for mortgage-backed securities. $30 billion to clean up Bear Stearns. Then it was hundreds of billions more for AIG and money market mutual funds and short-term loans to businesses. Then last month, the Fed announced three new huge programs, pledging hundreds of billions more for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the credit card industry, and Citigroup. Again, historian Alan Meltzer.
They move from thing to thing as problems arose in each area.
The total tab? More than $1.2 trillion, with promises of up to $4 trillion more. In return for these loans, the Fed's accepted a huge range of risky, possibly worthless, assets as collateral.
It is taking as collateral, and in some cases purchasing outright, risky assets, which is something it's never done in its history.
And Blinder says the Fed could easily lose money on these deals.
What happens if it runs a loss? Those losses go to the taxpayer, basically.
And that puts the Federal Reserve in an uncomfortable position. It's made huge bets in its bid to save the economy. But in the process, it's put more than $1 trillion of taxpayer money at risk. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Coming up, turning down noise pollution in India.
One of the researchers has revealed one-third of the rickshaw drivers suffer hearing loss after driving for several years on the roads.
But first, let's do the numbers. Some good news about consumer spending at last gave Wall Street a little holiday cheer today. Not much trading, though. The Dow gained more than 0.5%, 48 points to close at 8,468. The NASDAQ rose 0.2%, 3 points to finish at 1524. And the S&P climbed 0.5%, nearly 5 points to 868. Financial and retail shares lifted on better-than-expected news on consumer spending and durable goods orders. Abercrombie and Fitch streaked nearly 6% higher. Nordstrom pushed up 4.25%. The shine continued to come off Apple, which dropped 1.5%. Rival Microsoft, meanwhile, fell 0.5%. Bonds gained a fraction. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 2.17%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
What's
the connection between Girl Scout cookies and margin calls. Check out the Marketplace Decoder on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Stock markets in the U.S. and other parts of the world are closed for the holiday. It's a day for unwrapping. Hopefully Santa will have made it through the snow and storms. And on December 25th, 1776, General George Washington made it through the storm. Leading troops across the icy Delaware River during the night, he successfully pulled off a surprise attack on British and Hessian troops at Trenton, New Jersey, scoring some serious points during the American Revolution. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Usually by this time of year, retailers are riding high, anticipating big profits, and complaints about the commercialization of Christmas start to fill the air. This year, not so much. Consumers are cooling their heels to see just how low prices will go, and Santa's list is most likely a bit shorter this year. Commentator David Frum thinks a little more hoopla might be just what the doctor ordered.
Unless you're skiing, who likes snow at Christmas? Cold, wet, slushy, and by the way, entirely alien to the experience of Mary, Joseph, and baby Jesus in their Mediterranean manger. Still, if you're stuck on a Pacific atoll in World War II, well, you don't have to be Irving Berlin to notice that under those circumstances, a white Christmas will be exactly what you yearn for. Everything is relative. A couple of years ago, at the top of the mortgage bubble, you could feel a little nausea at the consumption on display in the local shopping malls. Americans were tapping their home equity to buy 104-inch flat-screen TVs or to drive away the fully loaded sports coupe from their auto dealers' holiday sales events. It was not only the very religious who sometimes muttered that Americans would do better to remember the reason for the season. Back then, a little less materialism seemed just what the doctor ordered. Well, if anyone ever made that wish, it has come true. Retail sales have slumped. Shoppers are staying out of stores. Pollsters are reporting that more Americans are planning homemade gifts, toffee instead of Tiffany's. Yet it is hard to celebrate this return to depression style. Adversity is not as good for the character as advertised. Nobody tramples security guards to death in a rush to pay retail. In bad times, donations to charity drop. The bells of the Salvation Army ring in vain. The U.S. Marine Corps' calls for toys for tots go unheeded. We hear daily of friends and neighbors who have lost jobs, homes, and retirement hopes. And we begin to think, maybe a big part of the reason for the season is the universal human need for a bit of fun, a splurge when the days grow short. Maybe gifts aren't only symbols of consumerism run amok, but also occasions to bring joy to those we love. Maybe, in this tough year, it's not only merchants or dreaming of a commercial Christmas, just like the ones we used to know.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His most recent book is called Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. Want to share some of that holiday spirit? Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. Sometimes when I'm driving through certain neighborhoods in Pasadena, where I live, you know, the neighborhoods you dream of someday living in, I find myself wanting to walk up to the front door, knock, and ask, how did you get all this? What did you do? Especially during the holidays when they're all decked out in beautiful lights and decorations. Well, former Money Magazine editor Ryan D'Agostino did just that. Walked up to front doors of giant homes across the country and collected stories for his new book, Rich Like Them. Ryan D'Agostino, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, Ryan, but I wonder whether you might be finding that nobody really wants to hear about rich people right now.
Well, no one wants to hear about a certain kind of rich people, maybe the ones who make the headlines. But one of the most surprising things I found with the people I talked to was humility. I think I was expecting all the people behind those gates and those big houses on the water to be these sort of brash, you know, take no prisoners. I just, you know, I clawed my way to the top and you got to look out for yourself. And there were certainly some of that. But for the most part, what they were was people who did not put themselves on a pedestal.
One of the chapters in your book is titled Luck Doesn't Exist.
Yes.
Is this the old kind of, you know, work hard enough and it'll happen argument? Because if so, you know, a lot of us who work really hard are wondering when we're going to become millionaires.
That's part of it, but there's another piece of it, which is resourcefulness. I met a retired stockbroker named Bob Grosnoff, and I said, you know, there's a lot of stockbrokers out there, Bob, but they're not all living here in this beautiful house. How did you rise above the millions of stockbrokers you've worked with over the years? And he said, well, when I was first starting out, it was not a good time in the stock market. People were running scared. It was up and down like a roller coaster. So he started selling short-term municipal debt, which basically just was a very, very safe thing that people could do. It got 7.5%, and it was just a place to park some money. So what he was trying to do was sort of accumulate clients for later when things picked up. And sure enough, when things picked up, he gets a call one day from a guy who owns, you know, half the coal mines in the South. And the guy's on his private plane and said, okay, Bob, you did me good. Let's start buying some stock. Huh. And they went literally through the alphabet and, you know, placed an order in the millions of dollars. Bob got lucky, I guess. That's what his coworkers thought. But Bob didn't really get lucky. Bob spent 5 years, you know, laying that foundation.
So given the fact that so many people in this country are in such economic turmoil right now, what lesson do you think they can take away from all these very wealthy people, you know, self-made or not, it's hard to imagine that you can get yourself to that point.
A few of the people I spoke with, I've called recently, the ones I kind of hit it off with, and I said, look, you know, A, are you still rich? And B, what's your advice right now? And what struck me was that every single one of them said, my advice is the same. Everything I told you is the same. So point being, if you can stomach sort of, you know, reading the headlines but not having them convince you that because of everything that's going on in the world, you can't do anything. If you can just forget about that and control the things you can control, I think you stand a chance. That's what I'm hoping these people will inspire our readers to do.
Ryan D'Agostino is the author of the forthcoming Rich Like Them, My Door-to-Door Search for the Secrets of Wealth in America's Richest Neighborhoods. Ryan, thanks so much.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
All those holiday deals being offered by Detroit automakers? Yeah, they pale in comparison to the Nano from India's Tata Motors. It'll be the cheapest car in the world, if it ever gets released. It was announced with great fanfare back in January, but since then it's been plagued by everything from the slumping economy to protests from farmers after Tata built a factory on their land. An October release date got pushed to this month, and now it's been pushed again to March of next year. Some Indians wouldn't mind even more delays, though. They're worried that a wave of Nanos could make their bad urban pollution worse. Not the kind of pollution you'd think, though. Marketplace's Rico Galliano explains.
At a truck stop on the outskirts of Mumbai, truckers lovingly work on their vehicles. Every truck is hand-painted in bright colors. They look like circus caravans. And on the back bumper of every single one are painted the words, "Horn okay, please." I asked trucker Saik Nazir, why?
Horn okay, please, means if we're backing up, cars behind us should honk their horn, so we know someone's back there.
That may have been true once, but these days the sign seems more like just a tradition. Because in today's India, drivers basically never stop honking. This is Mumbai on a Friday night. And it's not even as bad as Indian city noise can get. Mumbai laws at least prohibit the use of air horns, which sound like this.
My God, that is loud.
Air horn laws aren't always enforced, though. And the fear is if tons of super cheap Nanos start rolling onto clogged Indian streets, horn use of every stripe could reach brain-shattering proportions.
I believe it's in Indians' culture and psychology to make noise wherever they are.
Vipul Shah is a recent business administration grad in the Indian city of Pune. A few years ago, he returned home from studying in relatively silent England.
The first thing I noticed was tremendous amount of noise here, and that was intolerable. And I initiated a campaign called Quiet India Campaign, and our motto was, "Horn not okay, please."
Last year, he got national media attention by putting the "Horn not okay" slogan on a T-shirt and taking a 75-mile bike trip. The campaign held student rallies in several cities. Pune's mayor kicked off the first one with a speech, and traffic cops were boosters too.
They were like, "Oh, you're doing it for us, actually, because they are the ones who actually suffer from the noise pollution and the rickshaw drivers."
That's surprising, since in my experience, rickshaw drivers, they pilot little three-wheeled open-air taxis, honk more than almost anyone in the country.
So the rickshaws actually like this idea?
Definitely. It's actually one of the researchers has revealed one-third of the rickshaw drivers suffer hearing loss after driving for several years on the roads.
Yeah, it is true.
Sharad Rao is president of Mumbai's Auto Rickshaw Union. He agrees horn noise leaves his driver's ears ringing. But does he think a bunch of students from Pune have actually made horn use not okay?
I welcome the campaign by the Pune youngsters. But till there is some restriction on vehicle numbers, the horn use is not going to be stopped.
Is it possible to keep vehicular traffic down?
Impossible. I don't believe in it.
And why should he? Last April, an official no-honking day in Mumbai seemed to fall on deaf ears. Despite an ad campaign featuring Bollywood celebrities, and despite the threat of a traffic ticket, the city's drivers honked pretty much as usual. Meanwhile, the UN projects by 2015, Mumbai alone will be home to 22 million people, more than almost any urban area on Earth. More and more of them will be driving cars. In Mumbai, India, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace!
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, it is a tradition on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange each Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. Traders stop to belt out a tune about waiting for the rain to pass. This year's version hit home more than usual. The tradition started as a way to lighten the mood in the days following the great crash of 1929. Wait till the sun shines, Nellie, and it will. Won't it? And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 48 points, more than 0.5%. The Nasdaq gained 3 points, 0.2%. And the S&P 500 added 5 points, 0.5%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Next time, dealing with a wintry job market.
It's a very hard slap in the face because college was not a breeze, you know? So all the work that was supposed to pay off at the end, it's just not.
I'm Tess Vigeland. For those of you celebrating it, a very Merry Christmas. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.